You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Now, this podcast is about diversity and inclusion in the food industry. Now, there's always been an obvious moral case for diversity and inclusion, but equally, there's a compelling business case as well, from broadening market reach to bringing fresh perspectives to strategic planning, especially the case for the food and grocery sector, where a hugely diverse workforce should be able to help businesses get closer to customers, tap into underserved markets and keep ahead of fast shifting customer demand. Now, I want to explore what progress we're seeing with diversity and inclusion. What's new, what's working and not working, and what strategies are best for making a positive difference. Joining us to discuss it are Amanda Scott, Director of Talent, Learning and Diversity and Inclusion at Compass Group.
Hello.
Catherine Gillespie, People and Culture Director, Coca-Cola European Partners.
Hello.
And Dan Robertson, Director of Vasida Consulting.
Hello.
Now, just to start off with Amanda, let's lay all this out in a nice and clear way. What do we mean by inclusion? What do we mean by diversity? It may seem obvious, but why are they important and why are they important to business?
Diversity is about the recognition that there are differences and acknowledging that. And inclusion is really about where we value those differences and recognise that they are what makes it makes a great team, it makes a great society, and enabling everyone to kind of come to work, do their best and be judged on who they are as an individual, not what any of their identifying characteristics might be.
Fantastic. Okay. Now, Catherine, it's easy to get lost in language with this and in sort of terminology rather than specifics. So in terms of a business perspective, but at a corporate reporting level and in terms of bottom line, what does it mean?
I think it means lots of different things. I think we've mentioned a few of them already. It's important that we reflect our societies, our consumers, our customers, all those types of things. But also the massive engagement opportunity with our employees as well, because, you know, we buy into when everybody can feel like they can be themselves and be at their best and bring their strengths. That's going to be good for our business as well. But equally, you know, when we think about the future of the business, it's business critical, because we won't be able to, you know, create a future for the business or growth if we don't think differently and we don't have new ideas and we don't have fresh perspectives that I've always been mentioned. So it means lots of different things. But when you put it all together, it's business critical. And I think, you know, that's probably where we are today. It's maybe not always been that way for the last few years, across businesses. But I think today we see it as an important strategy for our business to grow as any other.
So Dan, that's really interesting. So Catherine's talking about change and the fact that it wasn't as important before, but it is now. Now, how is the food industry in the UK doing in terms of diversity and inclusion? Are we getting it right? Is there still a long way to go? Are there horrific instances where it's just not working? What's the state of diversity and inclusion right now?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. And I think, as Amanda and Catherine are articulating, is it is quite important, actually, to tease out those two things, because actually what we're measuring is two things at the same time. So we're measuring how we're doing on the DBIT, so how we're doing in relation to diversity, so bringing difference into our businesses. But actually what's really interesting about the question, I suppose, is, often people assume that as we start to increase our levels of difference, then at the same time, we automatically increase our levels of inclusivity and belonging. And that's obviously not the case. So I think the question is about saying, how's the industry doing on the diversity aspect, but separately, but connected to that, how are we doing on the inclusion aspect? And, you know, you can imagine, I think it's a bit of a mixed picture, actually. I think there are some organisations that are doing some great work, actually, and they're really focused on saying, you know, we really want to bring difference in for those arguments that, you know, Amanda and Catherine have talked about in terms of employee engagement and innovation and the rest of it. I think there is a bit more work to do on inclusion overall. And I think actually, interestingly, for me, it goes back to the business case, because we're all quite familiar with those arguments around, you know, when we treat people with respect and, you know, all of those things around inclusivity, we get stuff out of that. So we get that higher engagement, we get the, you know, the innovation, the creativity and the rest of it. I think George Floyd has been a bit of a game changer. And I think, I think for all industries, actually, I think we're all now pausing and reflecting and saying, actually, the business case, I think the business case has shifted quite significantly because of George Floyd and COVID. I think there's a lot of conversation about health and well-being, all of that. So my response would be usual thing, really great in some areas, some pockets, doing really well, but obviously still work to do on both the DBIT and the IBIT.
Yeah. Now, this is a question to all of you, really. I mean, should the ambition really be that we shouldn't be having this conversation at all, that your jobs in diversity and inclusion shouldn't exist in 5 years' time?
I'd say absolutely, yes. I think we all recognise that this has taken generations to, you know, of evolution in the workplace to get to, and indeed society to get to where we've got to, and we're a long way off being completely balanced and inclusive on all levels. And I think that there is a lot of work to do, but I think it's really positive that it's much more a conversation now. And that's, you know, acknowledging that there is an issue and that we need to fix it, I think, is a really good start. But there is a lot of work to do. But yeah, the dream would be absolutely that it's not a topic.
Do you see that as something possible within the next 5, 10, 15 years?
I'm going to jump in here, actually. I think that's right. I mean, the dream is that we all kind of, you know, do ourselves out of a job to a certain extent. Is it possible in the next 5 to 6 years? Absolutely not. I think, you know, I do think we have to have a reality. I wish it was. I think the problem, we all know, you know, we don't need to go into the whole kind of psychobabble, but we all know, you know, how human beings operate. And we all know that the biases that we're up against. You know, I've been working in the field of inclusivity and leadership for over 20 years. You know, this is not just around trying to do some stuff on the edges. You know, the problem here is that inequality and bias is really literally embedded within the structure of human thinking. You know, we have this natural gravitational pull to people that look like us and sound like us, you know, that similarity, the affinity bias, and all of that stuff becomes embedded within our organizational systems and processes. And, you know, Compass and Coca-Cola, I won't speak for them, obviously, but, you know, they've obviously been doing some brilliant work and great work of trying to mitigate all these biases, have other organisations, but it's definitely not a quick fix, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start getting into the depth of this, because I think when we start understanding the problem a little bit more, hopefully we will start coming up with some of the potential solutions to fixing it. So, Amanda, let's start with you. Now, Compass Group is a vast multinational contract food service business. You employ, is it over 600,000 people around the world? Is that right?
Yeah, that's about pre-COVID, that's about right, yeah.
Yeah. So what does diversity, inclusion and inclusion look like at your organisation? Because you must have a very diverse workforce just because you are a global company as well.
Yeah, we do. And I can only speak really speak with any level of insight into the UK and Ireland business, which is the area that I look after. And we've got over 40,000 employees across the UK and Ireland. And based on, you know, the makeup in terms of what's the diversity split, if we take the diversity first, you know, women make up over 2/3 of our workforce across all levels. We've got currently quite a balance at the exec level. So the senior managing director level who are accountable for the business is pretty well split from a gender perspective. But we have this, like other organisations, this kind of cliff where the gender balance really skews towards men. And that's one of the things that we've taken a look at. So, you know, overall at the front line of our organisation, women are very well represented. As we go to the kind of middle to senior level, not so much. From an ethnicity perspective, and these are the two measures that we actually have data for, we reflect the working population in the UK of around 14% based on the ONS data. But that reduces as we go through the organisation from a seniority perspective right up to the exec level, where we really are not representative of the population. So those are areas that we are absolutely focused on.
And when you say focused on, what does that mean? Is it a problem that needs solving? And if so, how do you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's if I had the answer to that, I'd probably be very, very rich. I think.
Well, we'd stop there, really, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I'd just retire now. So I think when I say focused on, it's a core part of our D&I strategy for the UK and Ireland. And it's there are areas where we're taking proactive steps and actions. I think one thing to recognise, and we touched on this earlier, this is not something that you're going to see the results of this year or next year, you know, hopefully 5 years. But this is about, you know, really changing systemic and cultural norms that we have and changing over time. So, you know, we're very deliberate in choosing a focus area. So last year it was kind of let's look at gender, because we've got some, you know, specific issues that the data is telling us we should look at and our employees are telling us we should look at. Let's put some actions in place to focus on that. And we had
Can you give me a couple of specifics, just so we know, we understand a little bit more about the detail.
So I referenced the cliff that women in our organisation seem to face at sort of middle manager level. So we asked women who were just on the precipice of that cliff to say, what is it? Why don't more women feature in the more senior levels? You are at the level below that. How would we help you to progress to that level? What are the barriers and what kind of things would help you? So we really engaged those, you know, the people who were affected in the conversation. And they talked about the stuff that, you know, I'm sure is replicated across many organizations around, you know, I'm concerned that I wouldn't have the work-life balance that I need. I don't have the right networks. I'm not sure I have the right skills. I don't really know enough people. The visibility of opportunity is not there for me. I don't know how to get these jobs. I don't have a sponsor. Those kind of conversations. So that was what we said, right, okay, let's take a look at that and take a cohort and try and address that. So what are the steps we need to put in place around giving them sponsors? We ran a really positive course with Talking Talent on when, you know, giving them some of the confidence boosting skills that I feel that they said they didn't have. We allocated an exec sponsor. We took more interest in what's your career plan and how do we get you to those levels, rather than realize that, well, you needed this experience, but well, we didn't give you this experience, hence we can't put you in that more senior job. We're being much more targeted to that. So that would be one example of something we did. And I could rhyme off a lot, but I don't want to hold the conversation. But it's about, I think in short, it's about looking at what you think the issue is based on the data or the feedback or the issues that you're seeing arising in the organisation, taking a step back and engaging those who are impacted. And we did similar focus on ethnicity. We asked people from ethnic minority backgrounds in our organisation, what is it? What's it like for you in our organisation, and what can we do to make it a more positive experience for you?
And I presume a set of these solutions are based on sort of personal development or and sort of within the corporate structure. Yeah. I assume that there is a cost associated with that. You know, if you're going to help people, you know, with skills and training and setting up networks for them and things like that, there is a cost. Now, but is there a compensatory benefit to that cost?
Well, I think absolutely, because we talked earlier about what's the business case and all of that stuff around, you know, the inclusion, the better performance, reflecting society. You know, we're not a customer facing business, so we're not necessarily playing to what our customers would expect, but we're business to business organisations. So our clients expect us to have certain standards in place around the way we treat our people. So absolutely, we have to. There's a kind of benefit there. Just, I mean, in very crude terms, in terms of winning business, it's kind of, not only is it the right thing to do, but it will win us business. So there's definitely an investment, but I think the cost far outweighs the investment that we needed to put in.
Yeah, and at a corporate reporting level, are diversity and inclusion targets and issues important to shareholders?
Yeah, I think increasingly so. We get many more questions from our investors on that than I've seen in the past, and I've worked for other big corporations.
So, and is that a moral imperative or an economic imperative?
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I think it's both. I mean, I think there's all sorts of things bound up in it, not only your bottom line, but the way that you treat people, your reputation. So again, back to that, do people want to do business with an organisation that cares about diversity, that cares about its people? I think the answer is generally yes. So I think there's lots of drivers for it, but it's definitely visible.
Yeah. Now, your CEO, Dominic Blakemore, started in January 2018. So not that long ago, really, in terms of corporate structure.
Yeah.
Was there a female candidate anywhere near that level? And I don't know how he became CEO, but was there ever an opportunity for a woman to be at that level?
Well, it predates me, so I couldn't comment, but I would say
that
Dominic is the CEO from a group perspective, but but the finance director and the chief people officer are both females. And that's actually reflected in the UK and Ireland business, where our CEO, our MD is male, but are both the people director and the finance director are female. So. So I couldn't comment specifically on Dominic. He's a great CEO, regardless of his gender.
Nicely put. Now, just one more question, really. How do you support the delivery on diversity and inclusion across? I mean, you have multiple sites. What are the strategies? What are the tools and techniques that you've used that work best?
Yeah, this is one of our biggest challenges, because we have, I think, we have tens of thousands of people over thousands of sites. And one of a couple of things. One was the rollout of our Dignity at Work programme, which really was about awareness raising and expectation setting of how we should treat people, and that we treat each other as individuals and we don't discriminate on the basis of any characteristics, be that gender, ethnicity or mental health status. So that is a mandatory programme. For everyone, it's an online 30-minute or so module with a really powerful video. So that's the kind of the basic, and that sort of reaches everyone in the organisation. We've put in place certain guidance around how we recruit people from a diversity perspective, how we develop people, and that the diversity lens is always on there. But really, it's about changing behaviours. Those are the kind of hygiene factors. It's really about changing behaviours and getting people involved in the conversation. And what we've found has been working quite well is the setting up of employee networks. Now, that's a relatively small number of people, up to 20, who really drive the action. But beyond that, we are building an ambassadors network where we have hundreds of people who are, the cheerleaders for, be it mental health, ethnicity, women, on the front line to get the conversation going, to keep, to give us the feedback around what's happening at the ground, what kind of resources and tools they might need to make changes. So that's the strategy at the moment, is to really engage our people. And that has been working tremendously well so far.
Excellent. Okay. Right. Let's move on to we'll come back to chatting to everyone later, but let's move on to Catherine Gillespie, People and Culture Director at Coca-Cola European Partners. Now, the whole diversity inclusion issue, it's a, Is it something that gets in the way of, you know, the normal functioning of a complex company, or is it some, is it a problem that has to be solved?
I don't think it gets in the way. I think it helps, and it certainly is a problem that needs to be solved. And I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, we've had I&D plans for years, but I think really in the last 3 years, we've probably made more progress than the previous 10. And I think that people see it as adding to the business, not taking away from it. And actually what's good is, you know, these things, as we know, don't happen overnight, but when you get good practices in talent and hiring and things like that, you know, it just becomes the expected. Which is great to see, but I think we'll all say the same thing. There isn't one silver bullet. It's lots of different things that you need to kind of integrate into everything that you're doing as an organisation before it becomes, rather than I&D, it just becomes talent and culture of the organisation.
That's right. I mean, you know, the ultimate goal should be, we shouldn't be talking about people of race and gender and ethnicity. We should just be talking about people. But it's, you know, as Dan mentioned, these issues are maybe unlikely to ever go away at their core. Do you believe that that's the case?
I certainly think we are in no danger of that going away at any time soon. But I still, you know, I'm hopeful because I do see progress happening. And I think, you know, when I look at CCP, you know, in our own business, it's great to see. We talk about I&D, not D&I, because probably for those 10 years that I referred to before, we were very focused on diversity, and gender even more so in that. And we kind of flipped it and said, you know, it's more than that. And actually, the inclusion, you can't have inclusion without diversity, you can't have diversity without inclusion. So you really do need these two things to work together and to be moving at the same time. So we really done a lot of the work on our culture, and we'll continue to do that work on our culture. And it's all been positive, you know, it's all positive. But, you know, when you do open it up to inclusion and all aspects of diversity, by the way, not just one, you find that it helps with everything, because inclusion is everybody. So you're welcoming everybody into the organisation and into the conversation. You know, when, you know, I don't mind admitting, when we had a real singular focus on a women's network, which was really positively attended by women, we did get kind of like this divide and this almost a further exclusion out of the conversation. So we have a message around, I think I mentioned it before, everyone's welcome to be yourself, be where you belong. And we want to talk to everybody, wherever you are in the organisation. We want you to feel like you can fully be yourself, feel valued for bringing strengths and have a sense of belonging. And we don't just want diverse groups to care about I&D. We want everybody to want that culture for us. And at the same time, we also have obvious diversity initiatives similar to what's already been mentioned as well. But the biggest learning for us, I guess, in the last 3 years has been around, don't underestimate that point on inclusion. You know, you can't, or I think it's going to be really hard to make lasting progress without working on inclusion at the same time as diversity.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking in overall conceptual terms about diversity, inclusion and issues, but could you give us some specifics? What do you mean, you know, as a specific problem that needed to be fixed or something that wasn't working and a way that you fixed it? You said over the last 3 years, you've made a huge amount of progress. Can you just give me some concrete examples of what sort of things have happened and what sort of things have changed?
Yes, I think first of all, on the inclusion kind of front. So we did describe what do we mean by having an inclusive culture. I just mentioned it before, the be yourself, be where you belong. And we've had almost like a campaign around inclusion. So helping people understand what does that mean? How do we help people really focus back in on being themselves? You know, we've also done listening groups previously, and maybe sometimes people say a certain type of person can be successful here. And we're like, well, we don't want it to be like that. You know, we hire people for their differences. And then we've got this thing, and I think large organisations do it, whereby once they've joined, we want everybody to act the same. You know, that's the opposite of what we want, right? So we want people to bring their individual strengths all the time. So we've had a campaign around management sessions, frontline sessions. We actually started with a discussion session around, instead of talking about inclusion, talk about exclusion. We said to people, when was the last time you felt like excluded? And, you know, for some people, they were like, right, that was this morning, let me tell you. And then for other people, it was like, I can't remember when I've ever felt excluded, which opens up other things, topics like privilege and things like that. So we've done a ton of things. You know, we've had external speakers that have kind of just grown people's awareness of what's it like to be excluded. and what's happening there as well. Another important thing that we've done, and which is just going from strength to strength, is instead of having just individual network groups or resource groups, we've got a group that we call Just Be Ambassadors, and they are inclusion ambassadors. And they're across all functions, all levels, all backgrounds, etc. And they're just people who are passionate about change and about culture and about creating an IND culture where everybody is welcome. And that just continues to grow because, I think we'll probably say, instead of it just being a topic that might look like it's important to HR, it becomes a business topic in the business's hands. And those ambassadors will hold local leaders to account. They'll activate across the year. Like, we just had an amazing Black History Month set of celebrations, education sessions. We haven't done that before because I think over time, last year we had an amazing set of activations across different diversity areas. And this year we've really stepped forward around culture and heritage, which probably a lot of people have. So, year to year is growing in momentum, and it's letting each group really feel welcome in the organisation and talk about issues that are affecting them. And probably the most impactful thing that's happened is that there is now a platform where people feel comfortable to share their own personal stories. So this year, very topical, we were working with one of our community partners on a campaign called Young and Black. It was amplifying young people's voices to talk about what it was like growing up Black and in Britain. And we got our employees to get involved in it who were comfortable. The power of personal storytelling is unbelievable. And so that's just another example of some of the things that we've been doing.
Now, with a lot of issues like this, it's not until you measure the problem that you realise the scale of it and possibly the benefit that you might get if you fix it. How do you measure things? How have you approached finding out what needs to be done?
So I would say we measure everything we can measure. We are one of those companies where the data is available. We'll measure it and we'll look at it. So we have targets and we measure them. One big change, though, I'd say we have made is to our employee group is to not go big on the targets, because they're not a secret, but they're not the reason for doing it. And we did find previously people might be a bit cynical going, oh, we've just got this target to hit, versus, for example, hiring the right person. So the targets are there, people know about them, but they're more of a leadership tool. And what we find is actually when we stick to the core values of why we're doing it and why it's important, that people are more open to it or less defensive, should I say. So we do measure everything that we can. I think...
And is that by survey, by management report? What's the actual tool for doing it?
We obviously keep data in terms of employees at different levels in the organisation, so we know what our representation levels are. We do quite a lot of engagement surveys, and there are a number of questions that kind of focus in on the inclusion and diversity and equity and fair treatment type areas. So we do those kind of half yearly at the latest. But the other thing that we have done a lot of is in your shoes sessions, or listening sessions, basically, with certain groups. So we had some listening sessions at the end of last year with some of our employees from ethnic minorities. And, it was hard listening to some of it, because I think the more we've done on inclusion and diversity, being totally open, the more people are comfortable to speak out and say, well, it's great that you're doing that, but that necessarily doesn't feel like that covers us. So, we had to listen really hard and not be defensive about it, and listen to, well, what are some of the barriers that are in the way. One of the things that I've definitely learned is it's not just about what you can measure, because we got some feedback saying, well, it's not just about who applies for the role in the first place, for example, because actually what happens when people have stopped applying because they think there's no point? So you've got to look for the data that's not there as well. So I think it's a combination of all these things that are important, but the listening sessions have definitely opened our eyes to barriers that are probably a bit invisible and a bit systemic, and we've got some actions working with those listening groups to help us work through. We're just about to launch an equity program for employees from ethnic minorities, and that'll be the first time we've done that, to be honest with you. We started to work on it last summer, but it'll be with them and their managers, because we realised that whilst we hire at a frontline level of our organisation, it's pretty diverse and balanced, but I think, like it's been mentioned already, when you go up the leadership chain and management, it does fall off a cliff, and that's not okay. So what are we going to, how can we have a programme that helps create more equity for this group of employees?
So your CEO, Damien Paul Gammell, been in the job for 4 years, I believe. When he came in, was there a woman in the running for the job?
When he came in, it was a...
Or anyone more diverse than Damien, I guess.
So our chairwoman is a female, Sol, and Damien works for her. And there is some female representatives on the leadership team. I think, I don't think there was, to be completely open. Obviously, we do work with Sol as our chairman. She is a woman. What we have done, though, is made efforts with our pipe fill for CEO. So we have kind of like doubled our country director female representation. So, you know, yeah, it's not where it should be, but there's certainly progress.
Yeah. And what tools need to be implemented to help more diversity at that level? Is it, again, is it skills and mentoring and networking?
I think all those things are important, but they're important to everyone. We've kind of talked about mentoring, but also sponsorship as well, because, you know, mentoring is great and we can all get benefits from it. But actually, you know, how can we help sponsor people through the organisation? We've been very careful to make sure that our programmes don't look like they are there to fix the individuals, because sometimes you can get that right. You can go, I'm being sent on a women's leadership programme. Does that mean the issues with me? And, you know, there is a room for those types of programmes, I think, but only when you're working on your overall culture as well. So we need to be working on our biases and removing, you know, and inclusion nudges and challenging ourselves on, are we making this progress? And our board of directors certainly been challenging us more and more over the last couple of years, I think, as Amanda mentioned.
Yeah. And what other specific techniques? I mean, reverse mentoring, what other tools have you been using that seem to work really well?
Yeah, so reverse mentoring has been brilliant so far. So we've just quite simply matched our leadership team with diverse members of our organisation from the ambassador group, and we just made the matching as diverse as possible. So, for example, our general manager at the time in the UK, we just had a change around, but our general manager in the UK was matched with a team leader from SidCorp, a frontline team leader, with completely different backgrounds, upbringings, you name it, perspectives. And the feedback is resoundingly positive, because whilst it feels a little bit odd at first, the leaders say, look, I'm seeing the organisation through a completely different lens than what I've seen before. I'm starting to, you know, when you see the issue, you can't unsee them. So some of my colleagues and me have been trying to really go, how do you help people see the issues, right? Because when you can see them properly, then you can't unsee them. And I think that's when progress is made. So reverse mentoring definitely helped. Skip layer conversations as well, which is when, you know, we get the leadership team to connect with the team of their direct reports and talk about inclusion. Just a half an hour, no agenda other than, let's talk about inclusion, tell me how we're doing, what are the opportunities, etc. We've also done inclusion hacks, where you get kind of a big group of people together and you just have a hacking session on inclusion. And we come up with different ideas and initiatives. We've had some brilliant ideas from that. You know, one idea was, it was about 3 years ago now, why don't we allow people to swap their bank holiday when they follow when they want to celebrate a different religious holiday versus forcing them to take Easter? And we were like, there's no reason why we can't do that. You know, so hacks can bring up those lots of small ideas that can really make a difference to different groups.
Yeah. And I can imagine things like that, which you're right, they're sort of, it's a small change, but it's a huge change at the same time. Okay, Dan, you've been very patient. Thank you very much for sticking with us. Now, firstly, one of your expertise is in unconscious bias. Can you tell us what it means and what its impact can be?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess at the basic level, it's kind of the point that I was making earlier. I have to say I'm a positive, you know, sort of optimist by heart, actually. So, but the problem is that unconscious bias basically means that as human beings, the way that we are socialized, the way that we're brought up, our experiences, they basically create a set of values, and those sets of values determine how we see the world outside, but also they determine how we view and also judge people who are similar to us and people who are different from us. And what the problem with unconscious bias is not the fact that we have them, because we all have them as human beings. It's the impact point. And we do know when we look at all of the data. And actually, I think this is quite interesting, because In a way, these days, as you know, organizations don't need to do the homework because the homework's been done. So we do know where the greatest hotspots are, if you like. So one is obviously around recruitment. So we know that when organizations are hiring, there's that tendency to hire people who are like them. Now, when I say that, I think what's important in terms of a caveat is sometimes is the implication that, well, you know, does that mean that white people only hire white people, et cetera, et cetera? And it's much, much more complex than that, as you can imagine. So actually, in terms of unconscious bias, often it's not necessarily only about those protected characteristics. It's often about things like, you know, personalities, thinking styles, you know, work styles and the rest of it. So that likability factor goes way beyond the race, the gender and all of that. And that's an important point to note, actually. But we know that we do know that kind of mini-me effect really kind of impacts that whole recruitment cycle. Now, if you think about recruitment, that impacts organizations' ability to hire different. So that impacts that diversity stuff we're talking about there. But as we've mentioned, the other half of the conversation is around inclusivity and what we want to feel included. We want to feel that we have, you know, our voices heard, we have opportunities, we have, you know, chances in terms of that progression and the rest of it. And we know that unconscious bias impacts two levels, really. So that's going too technical. One is what we call structural decision making. So the work allocation, we know that there are definitely differentials in terms of things like performance reviews, you know, who ends up in the kind of, you know, the top talent bucket and, you know, the rest of it. And we can map that out across those different groups and the rest of it. But we've got some watch out points around things like work allocation, performance reviews and the rest of it. But the other one is just the kind of subtleties, which is just, you know, those micro behaviors, the everyday check-in, the do we feel that we're, you know, invited to the conversation? Is our voice heard? Is it respected? All of that. So we've got to think about unconscious bias at two levels, actually. But I think the beauty of this is, you know, there's been quite a lot of conversations we all know on unconscious bias. And I think most organizations know pretty much what it is and what the impact is. And that's a good thing. Because as we've heard from Amanda and Catherine, actually, there's some great activities going on, which is essentially designed to kind of mitigate some of those kind of unconscious biases that we see.
So what about, going back to the business case, I mean, let's talk hard cash here, and put the moral imperative aside. What is it that a business can gain from having a more diverse and inclusive workforce?
Well, I think it's an interesting question, and actually, I don't think we should avoid the morals. And in fact, I'll come back to that in a second. But if you want to focus on the hard cash, I think what we know is that diversity and inclusion is not an end in itself. You know, it leads to something, and what it leads to, as you know, as Amanda and Catherine have said, is it leads to, particularly the inclusion aspect, people feeling part of the team. So we get a higher uptake in terms of employee motivation. We get higher levels mm-hmm. of engagement. When we've got a culture which really values those differences, we get high levels of innovation, creativity. And what all of that stuff gives us, it essentially gives us insight. So it gives us insight into the world outside. And I think, you know, most organizations have two really big strategic assets. And one of those assets, apart from the kind of you know, structural assets, is the people, the talent. And the other asset is our customers. So no business can really survive without the customers. But both of those big assets are diverse by nature. So if we want to be financially successful as an organization, we've got to make sure that we are tuned into those different trends of the changing market. So we know that we can do that when we have the difference of thinking, but when we have the culture which allows, you know, that difference to thrive and the rest of it. And you know, all of that stuff has been mapped. So there was a really interesting piece of research by Boston Consulting Group that, and I think is a really interesting piece of research, which is called The Mix That Matters. And it's the first real credible piece of research that I've seen that actually shows a correlation between organizational diversity and inclusion and profitability and innovation. I mean, there's all
Ooh, This is what we need. Okay.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, we can talk about this all day, I'm sure. And I'm sure, you know, again, Catherine and Amanda will have views on it. But there's loads of stats out there by McKinsey and all of that. But I think the BCG stuff is quite interesting because we can see the real connectivity, if you like, that scientific connectivity between inclusion and business outcomes. Because I think, you know, sometimes inclusion can feel a bit woolly and nebulous. Actually, and again, as Catherine was saying, is, you know, we can measure it. We can measure it through employee engagement surveys. So we do get a sense of how people are thinking the rest of it. What I would say, even though that stuff is all correct, is I do genuinely think, and I think particularly now, 2020, because of COVID and because of George Floyd, I think there's a recalibration, if you like, of the business case. I think leaders are really waking up. In fact, there's a really interesting story that just came out this morning from I think it was the CEO from PwC saying that the number one priority for leaders these days is health and well-being of their employees. And I think that moves us back a bit to say, yes, we know the numbers are there. We know that we can be profitable from this. But actually, I think it's a bit of a risk if we try and park the moral case and say, actually, it's only about the cash. I think that would become quite problematic for organisations, particularly in the context of COVID and particularly in the context of George Floyd. And there's more of a, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, actually. I think we've really got to balance this idea of moral capitalism, if you like. And it's interesting that the CEO of Microsoft talks a lot about reevaluating what capitalism is and talking about what is the role of the private sector in terms of, you know, being sustainable, but being kind of ethical as well, if you like.
So it sounds like the business outcomes are important, but they're relatively hard to define. So it's about being dynamic, engaged, and integrated companies. And I guess, yeah, a company that functions well is presumably a company that is diverse and inclusive.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think they're hard to define. I think actually, if we look at some solid business outcomes, when we look at the data, there's some very solid research that says, yes, we get financial reward, but there's some really significant research that says, you know, just on a base level, if we treat our people well, we get stuff back from that. We get all of that motivation, the engagement, the psychological contract is really strengthened. We get high levels of psychological safety. That leads to all that stuff around employee engagement, employee retention. So I think actually, I don't think we necessarily need to do a big selling job here, because I think most people recognize that there's lots of ways to look at the business case, but there is a business case for it. So I actually think we've kind of moved on from that conversation. And I think what the conversation is now is saying, right, what can we do? We know there's a business case. We know that unconscious bias gets in the way. What are the things that we can do to try and get the bias out of the system, if you like? And what are the things that we can do to try and, you know, to promote an inclusive culture? And again, there's some great examples from Catherine there about the kind of, you know, the inclusion hacks and, you know, those inclusion nudges, things like the employee resource groups. There's not one magic ingredient, obviously, but, you know, through a collection of activities, I'm not sure what an analogy might be, actually, maybe with the food and industry, it might be like, you know, baking a cake. You know, it's about, you've got to have lots of different ingredients to have that cake that really, you know, tastes good.
I'm always adamant that if there ain't no love in a cake, then it's going to taste
well. I think that's right, actually. And I think this is why I think the business case argument is quite an interesting one, because we can all come at this from the kind of hard metrics. And don't get me wrong, I think they're really important. But I think in a way we do need a bit more love, and I think we need a bit more love from leaders. And I think actually we are seeing that. You know, I think particularly this year because of COVID in particular. You know, I think leaders do recognise that actually things like health and well-being and really just checking in with colleagues, that's quite important. Yeah. And I think that's a great thing, actually, for sure.
I'd love to see that as a line in the corporate reporting. You know, how do we rate in love? Well, we've done pretty well this year. Okay, and now let's just shine the light at ourselves a little bit. For myself, Amanda and Catherine, how is the food industry doing, do you think, in terms of being an attractive destination to diverse groups? Obviously the food industry is vast and has so many different elements to it. But as a sector, is the food industry doing well or doing badly compared to other sectors?
So, as you say, it's a pretty diverse sector. And obviously from the Compass perspective and people like Compass, companies like Compass, we're at the kind of delivery of, you know, meals and food and events. And so that has been particularly hard hit by COVID. So, you know, I think that's going to be one of our challenges is kind of rebuilding our business going forward. Mm. Diversity is clearly going to play a big role in that. And I think just one other point on the whole kind of diversity point is that, you know, I think as Dan referred to, the narrative is expanding somewhat. It's not just about gender or ethnicity or it's much more all-encompassing, and I think that's a good thing. And, you know, the government talks about levelling up, and we're placing, as Compass, we signed the Social Mobility Pledge, we've signed up to the Living Wage Foundation to be a living wage employer. So encompassing people from different socioeconomic backgrounds is really important. And I think from our sector, from our side of the food industry, we have very many opportunities for people to join that don't have the traditional barriers to entry that other organisations might have, where you have to have certain qualifications. You know, as a service industry, we can offer the opportunity to all, and indeed we do, you know, regardless of your gender, your background, your ethnicity. So you can come into the organisation and you can progress. And that's something that we really want to focus on, particularly for the 16 to 24 year olds who are particularly hard hit. So I think, you know, from adversity comes opportunity, and I'm sure that's going to be the case post COVID. But from our side of the business, I appreciate that's different from the kind of food manufacturing side, the retail side. But we are very committed to opening up opportunity for everyone in society and kind of making that happen and giving people an opportunity to progress a career.
I can't avoid mentioning this. Now, is it possible to distance diversity and inclusion from politics when it's become such a political issue? We've had, we're just seeing the last shreds of Donald Trump leaving office at the moment, although he hasn't yet. Boris Johnson's made a fair amount of racially charged language, more when he was London mayor. We've also had, we're still in the throes of Brexit, which for a lot of people was much more about immigration than it was about economics or you know, domestic policy and sovereignty. I mean, do you find yourselves, all of you, rubbing up against politics or having to refer to it or having to keep an eye on it in terms of your D&I policy?
I'll take that one to start off with, because you can't divorce it. I totally agree. You know, it's more the lines are completely blurred. I just think we need to get beyond it being an excuse for not doing it. So I just remember some internal dialogue this year, as I'm sure were happening everywhere, which were, should we have a point of view? It's a political thing, you know, that type of thing. And so I think we need to just stamp that type of stuff out and kind of say call it politics, call it whatever you like, but it's important to our business, it's important to our employees. Let's not use that as an excuse not to go there. And I think, you know, it's a bad sign if it's a good sign, right? This year is a standout year for people being called out and people saying how they feel on stuff that's maybe not been said for quite some time, or certainly not in the way it's being said this year. And that's a positive thing, right? Because I'm happy that our culture had developed enough that people do feel more comfortable to say, well, what's our perspective on this? And what are we doing about it? And do we care about how this section of our workforce feels, et cetera? So, you know, from a negative play, there's lots of positives around it, and it provides an opportunity. And what I've been really clear on is when people try to use politics as a reason why we shouldn't engage, you know, I'm not buying that.
I mean, it's a very interesting question, and we could speak for a long time on it. I think I would say we need leaders at every level of society to, whether they're political leaders or organisation leaders, community leaders, to be promoting a kind of positive, inclusive message. And I mean, it kind of almost is just, for me, it's just common sense of why would you judge anyone on the colour of their skin or their gender? Or why would you? And why wouldn't it be a good thing? But I think, as you say, that's not always what we hear from different leaders in different countries. And I think I'm hopeful that we will start to see a shift, particularly in the US specifically, a shift in the way that we approach these conversations and the narrative that's coming. And, you know, there seems to be in Joe Biden particularly a more kind of inclusive approach than there was in Donald Trump. But I think, you know, we need to divorce it in some ways. And I agree, you know, we don't want to have politics and aligning ourselves with certain politics as an excuse, but we do need leadership in this. And I think also in the media, and I think a lot of what people believe is what they read in the media, either social media or print media. And I think there needs to be real leadership there, not to stoke up the divisions, but really focus on the kind of what's common.
Yeah. And Dan, just to come back to this idea, I mean, I know you were saying that the moral imperative is fundamental to it, but in a sense, is there not a beauty in saying to people who say, well, I don't agree with diversity and inclusion, isn't there a beauty in saying it's about business? The company will work better and make more money if we're more diverse. And then you throw back into people's faces the politics and their own moral issues, which may not be the same as your own.
No, I don't agree with that. Actually, I think that's a decoy. I think if we only focus on finances and we stop focusing on people, I think that's a problem, actually. And I genuinely don't think they're mutually exclusive. And also, I think the world has moved on. I think, you know, we started it's funny, actually, we've kind of gone circular. I mean, I've been in this field for quite a long time, actually. And I think, you know, in the 1980s, I wasn't around in those days, actually, I was at school. But in the 1980s, it was all equal opportunities. Then in the 1990s, it was all the kind of war for talent. And then we moved into the kind of metrics, and now we're going full circle back into the kind of moral case. I just think that, you know, we live in such a very complicated world, and the world is so defined by all sorts of things. And one of the things that it is defined by is identity politics. And, you know, whether we like it or not, that's just the case. And I think, unfortunately, because of some political leaders, identity has become more of an issue these days than it was previously. And that is just not going away. And I think any smart business leader will know that if they try to separate out the morals with the financial figures, I just don't think it's going to work anymore. You know, each organization has to find its own balance and the rest of it. But also I do think business has a moral imperative, actually. I think business has a duty of care, if you like, to its employees. And that duty of care is some of the obvious things around health, well-being. But I think the duty of care is also around psychological safety. It's around saying, you know, as a leader, I want you to work in a corporation that does value you, that does respect you. You know, I want to create a culture which make sure that there's opportunities for everyone, and that if there is bias, it is the responsibility of the leaders to try and mitigate that. And that's a moral conversation. I mean, we might not like the term morals. I mean, we can change the term if you like, but ultimately it's not only about making profit.
That's my worry, the changing the term. Now, if people substitute the word morals for politics, then suddenly it gets really, really horrid. Now, listen, we have gone on for longer than any other podcast that we've recorded for Table Talk. And so I'd just like to go around to everyone and just finish this off by saying, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the next 5 years? So, Amanda, how do you feel about the coming 5 years?
On the diversity and inclusion front, I'm optimistic.
And why? And just give us a very, very simple, what's the basis for that optimism?
I think there's a lot more focus on it. And I think we are going to be held to account on many different levels. And Dan touched on those earlier. But yeah, I think we are going to be held to account.
Excellent. Okay. Catherine.
Very optimistic. Similar answer, but I think it's got the answer would be mainly because it's gone mainstream, and it should go mainstream. You know, not just a side specialist topic for HR. It's a bit like the whole sustainability, recycling, but it's become mainstream and business critical. And I think for that reason, it can't. It will continue to move forward because we will be held to account, and we all will know that this is the thing that will help decide a business success in future or not. So I'm very, very optimistic.
And Dan?
I'm definitely optimistic. I think and actually if we look back, I suppose, to help us look forward, we've seen loads of brilliant change, over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I think we're all on a kind of a particular road going forward. The only caveat I would say is I wish people would slow down sometimes before they speak. And the reason I say that is because I don't do social media at all, actually. Because I think there's so many opportunities for us to jump in and criticise all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think I think sometimes we need a bit more of a healthy debate, but overall, definitely optimistic.
Yeah. Stop all that tweeting with capital letters and maybe the world will be a better place. Okay, well, thank you so much. I think we could have done several more hours on this, and I hope that we do come back to this because I think we can actually tear this apart a lot more and understand it more. Thank you so much. You've heard from Amanda Scott from Compass Group, Catherine Gillespie, Coca-Cola European Partners, and Dan Robertson, Vasida Consulting, and me, Stefan Gates. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.